The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Dear friends, we're going to start our panel, the second panel on ensuring reparation for victims of tortures and other ill treatment. And let me start. Every one of the panelists in the order that appeared here will talk for around 10 minutes, and then there's going to be time for questions. A couple of comments, and let me again issue my comments a titre personnel. This is we're in an academic setting, and everyone talks on its own, responsibility. There are different conditions of legitimacy, as the late Tom Frank would say, and that relates perhaps also to the former panel. One is who says things. That's a very important issue because, you know, in this case as a committee chair, I had to chair the meeting with the member states, and some member states say, well, you listen to terrorists or very bad people, and that's true. I mean, and I told them at that time, well, usually the people who complain that they have been tortured, they are not someone who works for the Rotary Club and gets at home very early in the night and puts the children to bed. I mean, hasn't been accused of not responding emails or phone calls right away or having a stable employment. Many of the people that resort to CAT are accused of being terrorists, but we did not know that the CAT has a provision that says that if you are a terrorist, you cannot complain if you are being tortured. Now, second problem is, of course, whether what you say is true. But the exclusion of a petition because you are a bad person or a very bad person or, you know, is something that would have one good side, that if we don't, since we have very limited resources, most of the topics we're dealing with will not be part of, I mean, will not require any, you know, time. But it's unbelievable how that continues to exist even in the common language. I mean, they show you are associated with this and that. When you are in the human rights community, you have to treat everyone the same, and that does not mean that you are not going to be sentenced. And it's a different thing who you are and whether you are right or not. From that perspective, legitimacy, the conditions of legitimacy sometimes conspire against neutral analysis because, as I repeat, in common sense, who you are plays a role in the matters of credibility. That's why governments, NGOs, different actors, lawyers know very well that the first things you do is to shoot to the pianist or the ones who bring bad news. But we have learned in this hemisphere and in other places that we cannot defend the human rights of everyone unless you establish every human being needs to be treated in accordance with validly accepted norms by states. Nobody imposed them. These norms, they accepted it, and that's our responsibility. The second condition of legitimacy is consistency, of course. You know, people, you need to be perceived as treating everyone the same way. There are issues, however, in creative supervision because sometimes you find yourself with a jurisprudence that is very clear in the wrong way. And the process of transformation in the common law tradition, those who work in the common law tradition know that very well, is preceded at a certain moment by confusion and lack of consistency and so forth. So it's interesting to know how the argument of consistency sometimes would deter the movement of the law, because a call for consistency could be a call for in a certain moment to keep a jurisprudence that is negative. So we have to be careful from that perspective in terms of how we analyze. That does not mean that there should not be requests for consistency, but in the complexities of the Supervisory organs, the sometimes uncertainty plays a role in the development of the protections of human rights. I can think of so many examples concerning that. The treatment of disappearances, extraordinary renditions, death penalty, and so forth and so on. So as we look at these conditions of legitimacy, we have to be careful. The third one is that this needs to be useful for something, or the system needs to have teeth. And that gets us into a third panel. I always mention the situation of a dictator in Central America who said once, I don't know why people complain that we don't have free elections here. Everyone can be a candidate. Everyone can do publicity. Everyone can vote. The only thing that I do is that I count the votes, he said. Well, if everyone can count, everyone can complain. The NGOs have a space, and that has been increased through the time. Not enough. They have an hour with translation. In the past, I remember when some of us entered into a CAT, we saw that the voice for the NGOs was the corridor. I mean, there was no translation time, no official meeting. They have been moved. Not enough is 1 hour preceding the treatment of a country. But so there have been movement in this. There are resource issues. But again, if everything can happen, you can denounce, you can do everything, but there is no reparation, no investigation and punishment, no compensation, I mean, then we have a problem like this concept of free elections that was supported by that dictator in Central America. And that will impact the legitimacy of a treaty body at the end. Because if it is much ado about nothing, that would create certainly a problem. Now, to explore what we can do to ensure reparations for victims of torture and other ill treatment, we have really a unique panel. You can read about them here, and I hope that we will have an opportunity through them to understand what is a victim. Who qualifies as a victim? I've seen countries, for example, in CAT saying, well, you know, terrorists are not entitled to, let me see, could be kept in secret detention facilities and have forfeited the rights of communication because they are terrorists. Then the notion of victim means that dependents, family members, children can become a victim, you know? And then, so what's the impact there? So the notion of victim will assist us. Second thing, whether Article, the standards and obligations that we have in Article 14, I mean, of course, doesn't apply only to torture, but also cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment and punishment. And so how we go about these two? The scope, the extension of state obligation under Article 12, prompt and impartial investigation, effective legislative, administrative, judicial, or other measures to prevent acts of torture in any territory under jurisdiction, rejection of impunity, state obligations for to parties' obligation for extraterritorial violations, also concerning reparations, and the scope of redress, compensation, and rehabilitation. Well, now, anyone who has worked with victims of torture knows that there are material damages, there are immaterial damages, there are measures of rehabilitation, but also there is a sense we don't want this to happen to anyone. So that involves the change of law, statutes, asking forgiveness, And then there are many things in the Inter-American system. I'm sure we will hear about that. So some of us believe that the general comments are not the solution for everything, but perhaps this is something that could be the object of a general comment, to give guidance to people and, you know, and to prompt a discussion about what can happen, and also to governments. Let me say also something. The governments have created an instruments like CAT, and like the convention and treaty body and CAT, to protect individuals against themselves. It's quite remarkable that this has been the result of events that took place after the Second World War mostly and reveal a commitment with certain norms, and that allow us to build on that and really give efficiency to a broad movement that led to the adoption of this instrument. And some of us feel that the matter then of reparations really will move ahead the promise that was undercut. Well, let me start then with the, let us all hear Christopher Hall, and I propose that you talk for around 10 minutes, all of you, and then we will have time for questions. This will be an exercise in cat to talk for 10 minutes, because I will tell you, if the 50 states that have not complied with presenting their reports on time were to do that, they will finish cat, because we can handle only 7 per session. So the good news is that they have delayed. So we have to handle the time, knowing that some people will not comply with it. So in this case, you will not comply with covering all the matters you want to, but that will allow for a conversation. So let us start then with Christopher, and welcome again all of you, and thank you for those of you who came from afar. I will police.
Thank you. How can the committee strengthen its scrutiny and recommendations concerning the implementation of Article 14 of the Convention Against Torture? First, what are some of the essential elements of the awkwardly worded article? It requires each state party to ensure in its legal system, normally entailing legislation, that the victim, a term that is not limited by nationality, of torture, which is not limited geographically to torture in territory of a state party subject to its jurisdiction, obtains an obligation of result, where this is possible, of course, redress, a term which today is understood to include all 5 forms of reparations, restitution, rehabilitation, compensation, satisfaction, and guarantees of non-repetition, and an enforceable right which requires access to a court to fair and adequate compensation, including the means for as full rehabilitation as possible. An ungainly phrase from 1984 that today would almost certainly include all forms of reparation. One component of this obligation under Article 14 is the obligation of each state party to ensure that each victim of torture subject to its jurisdiction has an enforceable right to obtain reparations for torture committed abroad, whether by a national or by a foreigner. The reasons why this is so and why the belated acceptance of by 2 states, Canada and the United Kingdom, of the interpretation of this provision by that great public international lawyer, President Ronald Reagan, as being geographically restricted only to torture committed in territory subject to a state party's jurisdiction is not correct, are set out in some detail in an article in the European Journal of International Law, which is in your CD-ROM, and won't be rehearsed here. Article 14, potentially one of the most important articles of the Convention, was largely overlooked by states, scholars, and the committee itself for nearly 2 decades. Then at its May 2005 session, when it confronted Canada's defense of its court's decision in the Buzari case against Iran, upholding the claim of state immunity by Iran in a civil suit for torture, a civil suit based on torture for reparations committed in Iran. After carefully considering the mutually exclusive and entirely speculative arguments by various members of the Canadian delegation about why Article 14 only applied to torture and territory subject to the state party's jurisdiction and not committed abroad, the committee expressed its concern about the absence of effective measures to provide civil compensation to the victims of torture in all cases, and recommended that Canada review its position under Article 14 of the Convention to ensure the provision of compensation through its civil jurisdiction to all victims of torture. Victims and those working on their behalf welcome this bold step forward to make this article and the effective tool for reparations envisaged by the drafters and hoped that this decision would mark the beginning of a consistent approach by the committee in its examination of each state report, leading perhaps to an authoritative general comment on the scope of Article 14, laying to rest once and for all the doubts about its scope by the Canadian courts, Ronald Reagan, two states and, one other state and an academic. What happened and what may have been the consequences? First, the committee did not ask each state party at subsequent sessions whether it provided for universal civil jurisdiction under Article 14, expressed concern about the failure of states to do so, and recommend that those states' parties which had failed to do so amend their legislation forthwith. Instead, over the next few sessions, it made three cryptic statements which possibly could be taken to refer to the obligation under Article 14 to permit victims to recover reparations for torture abroad. One, asking about compensation awarded to a victim of an Austrian CIVPOL officer abroad. Two, urging the Republic of Korea to ensure that all victims be able to obtain redress. And welcoming a French procedure for victims of terrorism abroad. At that point, Amnesty International, Redress, Interrights, and Justice intervened in the House of Lords in a case called Jones versus Ministry of Interior of Saudi Arabia, involving four United Kingdom nationals suing Saudi Arabia and its officials who had allegedly tortured them. The interveners argued that the Committee Against Torture's conclusions and recommendations with respect to Canada's report was an authoritative interpretation of the convention and that the United Kingdom had an obligation to ensure that the four victims could recover. However, in the absence of either an authoritative general comment on Article 14 or a consistent examination by the committee with respect to each state party in subsequent sessions, this argument fell on deaf ears. The House of Lords, in marked contrast to the International Court of Justice and national courts in other states, dismissed the legal authority of the committee's recommendation as slight. And one judge went so far as to say, as an interpretation of Article 14 or as a statement of international law, I regard it as having no value. Bearing this national court discussion in mind, as the four victims began preparing to apply to the European Court of Human Rights to challenge it, Amnesty International wrote to the chair of the committee on the 2nd of November 2007 to urge that it use an 8-point checklist to assess the compliance of states' parties with their obligations under Article 14, hoping that by the time the European Court of Human Rights heard the case, the committee would have established a strong, consistent approach confirming the conclusions and recommendations it took in 2005. What were the 8 points on the checklist? Because of time, I won't go through them now, but perhaps during questions I will go through them. But one was simply providing for asking states to provide the relevant legislation and court decisions, including copies of the legislation, not simply an account of it, and asking whether the right to reparations was restricted to victims who were nationals of the state party, whether the right to reparations was restricted to ill treatment committed by nationals of the state party, and whether reparations was restricted to torture or ill treatment committed in the territory subject to a state party's jurisdiction. What has been the practice of the committee since the November 2007 letter? A review of the past two sessions, April and May and November 2009, reveals some positive developments, but also considerable disappointment. The committee examined 14 state reports, Azerbaijan, Chad, Chile, Colombia, El Salvador, Honduras, Israel, Moldova, New Zealand, Nicaragua, Philippines, Slovakia, Spain, and Yemen. On the positive side, there's been a far greater scrutiny of reparations programs, particularly addressing discriminatory access to such programs, and greater but still not uniform consistency in the scrutiny of complaints by victims seeking reparations from officials and courts. There are disappointments, however. First, the committee and the Secretariat could insist that states provide electronically all relevant legislation and court decisions in the form of legible scanned versions. Even when such documents are not available in a UN language, by making them accessible on its website in the original language, it would facilitate analysis by civil society of the relevant passages, thus facilitating the dialogue between the committee, states' parties, and civil society. One such example of analysis by civil society, which could assist the work of the committee, often built upon the committee's scrutiny of state party reports, is the No Safe Haven series of papers on universal civil and criminal jurisdiction, which Amnesty International began publishing in October 2008 on the 10th anniversary of former Pinochet's arrest in London. These are two examples. On each of the 192 UN member states, six have been published so far on Bulgaria, Germany, Solomon Islands, Spain, Sweden, and Venezuela. Two other specific disappointments could be mentioned. First, apart from the examination of Chile's report, the five forms of reparations have not been mentioned. Second, and this is directly relevant to the case against the United Kingdom in the European Court of Human Rights, the committee, echoing some of the problems regarding its scrutiny of the universal criminal jurisdiction obligation under Article 5, missed the opportunity in each of the 14 state party examinations in 2009 to ask if the state party has provided for universal civil jurisdiction and to recommend that it do so without any improper conditions, such as recognition of claims of state or official immunities regarding torture, statutes of limitation, ne bis in idem, applicable to foreign court decisions, even if they were shams, prohibitions of retrospective national legislation to conduct that was already a crime under international law, dual criminality, recognition of foreign amnesties and similar measures of impunity, improper defenses such as superior orders, duress and necessity, weak principles of superior responsibility such as those modeled on Article 28 of the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, a requirement that the defendant have been in the state party before a criminal investigation and request for extradition made. This is important because most civil law countries permit civil claims to be made in criminal cases, or that the defendant be a resident of the state party for a civil suit filed and political control over the institution of cases or mutual legal assistance requested or granted, and also weak mutual assistance provisions or treaties. It is to be hoped that the committee will address these concerns as it strengthens its methods of work. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Christopher. Thank you very much, and thank you for being within the 10 minutes time. We move now to Juan Mendes.
Thank you very much for the invitation to speak. It's a pleasure to do so at WCL and also at the invitation of Amnesty International. Talking about reparations, I find it very hard to distinguish reparations from remedies, although, you know, nominally they should be treated differently. I think in the literature they are generally treated together and sometimes even interchangeably. In the case of torture, it's perhaps even more necessary to consider remedies and reparations in toto, because what we need to do is to prevent torture, to punish the acts of torture, and to make victims whole. And it's difficult to do all three of those things with a narrow vision of compensation. So I am going to deal in this very general way with reparations and remedies together. And I'm going to be guided by this excellent book on torture and international law produced by APT and CEHIL, which shows how broad and diversified the jurisprudence of many different organs has been. And so these jurisprudential developments give us a lot of guidance on all aspects of torture, but as well as for reparations and remedies for torture. And I would hope that a comparison of different organs and mechanisms can help the committee, the UN Committee Against Torture, which is one organ that has been making great contributions, continue to deepen those contributions and harmonize them as much as possible with the jurisprudence of other organs as well. So starting with remedies in the domestic jurisdiction, I am a big fan of habeas corpus. It's both a remedy and a safeguard, so it's a very important preventive mechanism. The Inter-American Court on Human Rights in Advisory Opinion Number 9 on habeas corpus in emergency situations made it very clear that the reason that habeas corpus cannot be suspended even under a state of emergency is because it doesn't only protect against arbitrary detention. It protects against mistreatment, it protects against disappearances, it protects against unlawful prison conditions, etc. So because of that, I think it's important to continue to insist that that domestic jurisdictions have a very robust way of dealing with habeas corpus. And I think one aspect that has not been explored sufficiently is that it's not enough to have habeas corpus in the books. It's not enough to have a kind of mechanical way of dealing with it by magistrates and judges. I think it's important for the treaty organs eventually to develop what is required of a judge in a habeas corpus proceedings. The attitude that has to accompany it. It's a very subjective attitude, but it has to be the will to conduct a robust investigation, to mobilize and go to the detention centers, to insist on seeing the victim of an arrest personally, physically. All of those things, I think, leave some room for development in the international jurisprudence, so that we can give guidance to domestic courts, but also treat them as requirements under international law. I think my second important remedy is the exclusionary rule, and it's well treated in the treaties themselves. But I think we need to go beyond the letter of the treaties, because both in the Inter-American and in the UN Convention Against Torture, what must be declared inadmissible is the confession or the direct evidence obtained under torture. And in order for this remedy to be effective as a preventive mechanism, we need to exclude all evidence to which torture leads the investigator. In that sense, I think the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine developed in American constitutional law, it should be our desideratum, our goal. We should make it such that it's counterproductive for the investigator to torture, because he's going to jeopardize the whole prosecutorial case. I think it's also very well developed and very well established by now, although it wasn't the case 30 or 25 years ago, that torture triggers an obligation on the part of the state to investigate, prosecute, and punish those responsible. As far back as 1980, in the height of the military dictatorship in Argentina, the Inter-American Commission said in a case called Frigerio, which, by the way, happened to a young girl in my hometown of Mar del Plata, Argentina, that the state was obligated to investigate, prosecute, and punish the perpetrators of the disappearance, torture, and eventual killing of Rosa Ana Frigerio. It's incredibly pioneering, because at that time the Commission must have thought this is completely, futile. They're never going to investigate, prosecute, and punish. And, you know, we should never say never. I mean, in Argentina today, Ms. Frigerio's case is being investigated, is being prosecuted, and some people are going to pay, even if it took 30-some years, but they are going to pay for doing what they did to her. And that leads us to the prohibition of amnesties, pardons, and other factors leading to impunity. And here, again, the UNCAT has had a great decision in this case called Urra Guridi versus Spain about pardons to Guardia Civil torturers. But here I want to highlight the Inter-American Court of Human Rights decisions in Barrios Altos and in Almonacid Arellano versus Chile, where the court has not only said that all those obstacles have to be removed, but that the state is obligated to deprive them of any legal effect in the domestic jurisdiction. And the interesting thing is that it happens. In Peru and in Chile, the domestic jurisdiction has felt bound by these decisions and has deprived amnesties, pardons, statutes of limitations, etc., of legal effect, so that these major crimes can and should be punished. And then finally, to insist that torture gives rise to both civil and criminal remedies in the domestic jurisdiction. I just read recently that as far back as 1939, the eminent jurist Roberto Ago, when he was a special rapporteur of the International Law Commission on State Responsibility, wrote that when it comes to some international crimes, civil and criminal jurisdiction exist and must exist together. And I read this in a separate opinion by Antonio Cansado Trindade in the Mirna Mac case against Guatemala. Here, the European Court of Human Rights has also in X and Y versus Netherlands, but then in many other cases have made it clear that there are some violations that, for which the main remedy, or at least the indispensable remedy, is criminal prosecution. But now talking more about reparations, more generally at the international level, I think we have by now embraced the idea that reparations have to be integral or holistic, comprehensive, and that they cannot we cannot let the states pick and choose what kind of reparation to offer. That has been very clearly established more than 20 years ago in the report of Theo van Vogt, who was a special rapporteur on compensation, but also reaffirmed in the reports of Duanet, Bassiouni, and more recently Diane Orenklicker on all on the same subjects. And it seems to me that in the case of torture, as in other crimes against humanity, the state is obligated first to the truth, second to justice, third to reparations, and fourth to institutional reform, including vetting or excluding from democratically constituted forces those people who are known to have committed atrocities like torture. Specifically about compensation, I think in the case of torture, if the victim has survived, it is relatively possible to apply the principle of restitutio ad integrum, that is, to restore the things that, as they were before the episode. And here I just want to spend a minute on the notion of punitive damages. When Claudio and I were representing the victims in the Velázquez-Rodríguez case, we went out of our way to try to persuade the court to establish punitive damages for the phenomenon of disappearances, in part because the disappearances were still raging in many parts of Latin America, and we wanted a weapon, an instrument by which we could dissuade countries from engaging in the practice. And we got an amicus curiae signed by many Latin American and European jurists saying that punitive damages were warranted because disappearances and torture within disappearances was such a wanton and cruel act. Unfortunately, the court didn't agree with us. It basically said in one sentence that punitive damages was not a part of international law. And in the separate opinion that I just mentioned by Antonio Cansado Trindade in the Mirna Mac case, he goes against the court on that and says that punitive damages are a part of international law and that it should be contemplated. He kind of turns around and defines punitive damages somewhat differently than we had tried to do in the Velázquez-Rodríguez case, because he says basically that what the court has been doing in establishing the obligation to to name schools by the name of the victim, to name streets, to express public apologies, etc., or even to pay damages to communities, like in the Alaboto case, etc., that's what he defines as punitive damages. And maybe he's right. Maybe that is the way to go, because he does say, and I agree with him, that we have to avoid the sensation that we can create windfalls for victims of torture, because then we, meaning the organs, everybody, will be accused of a sort of industry of reparations. And there I think he has a very important point. But I think the question of whether punitive damages in the sense of monetary damages could be and could be necessary to dissuade countries or states from engaging in deliberate and patterns of deliberate, systematic, wanton crimes is still open. I think it's still there, and we still need to think about it a little more. I just want to finish then with this question of practices and patterns that I think needs to be explored a little further. When torture is conducted as a matter of an ongoing practice and pattern, or very systematic and widespread, it constitutes a crime against humanity, and the Statute of Rome clearly makes it a punishable crime in international law. Some of these organs have called it aggravated torture, but I think in this sense it's important to note that it's regrettable that the European Court of Human Rights has been very hesitant to find patterns of violation, or at least it wasn't in the 90s. This may have changed in the more recent jurisprudence. It was very reluctant to find it, that the court always tried to find on a case-by-case basis a violation of torture. I think that's good as far as it goes. But when torture is state policy, we need more than that in order to make it stop. And treating them as individual cases may not do the trick. I'm sorry that I've run out of time, but I'm very grateful for your time.
Thank you very much, Juan. Now we move to Lorna. Lorna.
Thank you to the Washington College of Law and Amnesty International for inviting Redress to participate in this event. I'm speaking from the perspective of an organization which our mandate is to seek justice on behalf of torture survivors, so it's very much a victim-orientated approach that we take. In that respect, the Committee Against Torture is the authoritative interpreter of the Convention, is one of the key bodies that we look to for guidance and implementation of the right to a remedy and reparation. And really, when we're looking at the concluding observations and individual views on cases, the more detail that we see in terms of what the standards are on the right to effective remedy and full and adequate reparation, the better for us, and the better for states in knowing concretely what they have to do in order to comply with the Convention. We're increasingly seeing this approach with the committee. We can see that in a number of cases, as Juan Mendes referred to the Guridi against Spain case, but also a number of cases against Tunisia, we're increasingly seeing the committee looking at Article 14 and saying that it's not just about fair and adequate compensation, but redress also constitutes reparation, restitution, rehabilitation of the victim, and measures to guarantee non-recurrence. And in the concluding observations, as Christopher Hall already mentioned in terms of Chile, we're again seeing a more comprehensive approach to the question of reparation within concluding observations. And for myself, as a representative of an individual who was tortured in Chile under the Pinochet regime and who is based outside of Chile and is trying to pursue a claim in relation to his torture, these concluding observations were incredibly helpful in terms of being very concrete on the amnesty decree that is still in force, looking behind the amnesty law, not just saying it's incompatible with the convention, but looking at exactly how the Supreme Court is applying it, both in terms of individual cases and also in terms of reducing penalties because of the existence of the amnesty law. And at looking at rehabilitation programs and the lack of them for victims who are sitting outside of the state. So this very nuanced and detailed approach in the concluding observations has been incredibly helpful to us as victims' representatives. And this is what we're really looking for from the committee, is very practical, detailed, comprehensive analysis and interpretation of what the convention requires in terms of the substantive aspects of reparation, but also how it can be an enforceable right in terms of access to justice. And also looking at very practical ways to ensure that victims can exercise this right. And this is something that Florence from the Kenyan Human Rights Commission raised in the first panel in terms of the integral nature of victim and witness protection as a means to ensure the right to reparation. And that's something that has been raised by the committee in relation to Kenya in the last session. What's also important for us is to understand the institutional provision for reparation. And the committee has been quite good in looking at reparation programs, particularly from a transitional justice perspective. And the more that we can understand how and when these reparation programs comply with the requirements of the right to a remedy and reparation under the convention, the better. But also in terms of institutions like the Human Rights Commissions, and the committee often makes references to the need for states to implement recommendations on compensation and other forms of reparation. But it would be much more useful when we're trying to use these recommendations to actually understand why does the committee think that the state is obligated to implement the recommendations of a Human Rights Commission, and to understand the legal analysis behind that. And all of these points really go to my approach as someone who's representing victims and understanding more about what the committee requires in terms of remedy and reparation. But it's also important when we're litigating outside of the committee context and when we're representing victims outside of the committee context. And as Christopher Hall mentioned before, when we're litigating in regional courts or at the national level, and increasingly we have questions in terms of what the absolute prohibition of torture requires, particularly in terms of positive obligations, there are many questions that are coming up because of the current context. Here we're looking to the committee to understand what all these provisions mean. And the more that we can see in committee decisions, citation of its own jurisprudence, also engagement with the travaux, and citation of other international jurisprudence on the same points, the more difficult it's going to be for courts like the House of Lords in the case that Christopher Hall mentioned in the UK, in which the Committee Against Torture was dismissed as not an exclusively legal or an adjudicative body, which did not advance any analysis or interpretation of Article 14, and the legal authority of this recommendation is slight, is what the court said. But the more that the jurisprudence is cited within decisions and concluding observations, the more the travaux is engaged with, and the more there's other regional and international jurisprudence included in the decisions, it will be harder for these courts to say that there's not legal analysis, that this is not an international legal decision, even if the body is considered differently from a regular court. And the short time left, I just wanted to flag two particular issues on reparation that I think are interesting from the committee perspective. The first is that we often very much focus on Article 14 as the key provision for reparation within the committee, and of course it is one of the crucial provisions. But as Claudio mentioned at the beginning, Article 13 and 12 are also very important from a victim's perspective in understanding investigations as part of reparation, And I think that this is something that the committee could develop further when it's looking at the duty to investigate as not only leading to other forms of reparation, but also in and of itself as a means to participate and a realization of the right to the truth. And in a number of cases where the committee has looked at this issue, they have often talked about the victim not being informed of the results of the investigation as a problem in preventing them from bringing private prosecutions. But it would be very interesting if the committee could develop that further to look at why the victim not being informed of the results of the investigation is in and of itself a problem in relation to reparation. Since we're short of time, I'm just going to quickly jump to the issue of rehabilitation, which I think Nora is going to talk about next. This is an area in which we think it's crucial that not only the Committee Against Torture, but also other bodies really flesh out what it means. And the Committee Against Torture was actually the leader in recognizing the right to rehabilitation when it was included within the Convention. And the committee frequently refers to it in its jurisprudence and asks for information on rehabilitation services and tries to find out which victims are benefiting from it and encourages states to provide rehabilitation programs. But the difficulty is that the text of the convention and also the travaux don't explain what rehabilitation means. And we really need to understand this in order to develop a greater understanding and implement this right in practice. I think it's quite clear that it includes medical and psychological services, but there are broader rights that might be included. And the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, which is a 2009 convention, is quite helpful in understanding that it also relates to mental, social, and vocational ability of different victims, including torture survivors, to fully participate in all aspects of life. And it would be interesting for the committee to look into these other forms of rehabilitation in addition to the medical and psychological that is normally understood to entail. Also to look at what the chair mentioned before in terms of who it applies to, not just the direct torture survivor, but also the next of kin, and to understand what a social service actually is. Does it include employment, housing, education, these types of services? And just on that note, just to finish as well, I think it's very important for states and everyone that's working on these issues to understand that the right to rehabilitation is not extinguished when organizations provide this as a humanitarian assistance. This is something that is often made an argument to us when we're trying to develop the right to reparation on rehabilitation. They say, but they've already received this, or there's a national health service that can provide this. They don't understand it as actually the state's duty to provide that. So again, this is something that's very important to develop within that.
Nora is taking the time, so you need to finish. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Nora, your turn. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me and organizing this. And I will just have very few slides. I think it may be strategically now, right before lunch also. First of all, Dean Grossman, you opened the conference by saying that reparations for victims of torture is more an exception than a rule. And I think I will continue your phrase by saying, and given reparations, rehabilitation is more an exception than a rule. So based on this, my words today here will be on rehabilitation to victims and others who have been exposed to torture and other ill treatment, both as a form of reparation and as a form of intervention or assistance, understood in terms of health care to persons exposed to torture. I will concentrate on this, first of all, because rehabilitation is an issue that needs a lot stronger priority. And secondly, I think it is, in the terms of reparations, it is what is least spelled out and defined, as also Lorna has mentioned. And it also raises a lot of complicated issues in relation, of course, to the legal standards and definitions, but also in relation to the context in which rehabilitation services take place, the fact that rehabilitation is impossible and undoable without a wider and multi-professional approach, and often time is of essence here. And finally, we have to take into account the situation and the motivation for the person who has been tortured, him or herself. So the words that what I'm going to talk about today, I'm basically also talking about it as a psychologist myself, being actively involved in rehabilitation of persons who have survived torture. I did try to make the distinction between rehabilitation as a form of reparations and as a necessary health care and social assistance, not because these are separated phenomena in any ways, on the contrary, but because they relate to different phases in the process from the infliction of torture to justice and reparations being fulfilled. Persons who have been subjected to torture, whether they remain in their country where the torture has taken place or leave to another country as refugees or asylum seekers, they will frequently suffer from severe consequences mentally as well as physically, and often burdened with problems of social, practical, and economic nature. We are often confronted with information and documentation about effects of torture in form of physically detectable signs and reduced ability for movement and action, but less visible and often a lot more difficult to document and cure are the scars that are experienced as strong sense of shame and guilt, of worthlessness and humiliation, of feelings that one cannot be regarded as a human being with rights and dignity, constant lack of trust in others, and problems to relate to others after torture and systematic destruction of human contact and communication has taken place. And combined with intrusive memories, nightmares, and consequently lack of sleep, the challenges of everyday life may seem to be almost impossible to overcome. One's intellectual as well as one's sexual identity has often been extremely threatened by confusing, degrading, and dehumanizing methods of inflicting pain, directly aiming and attacking both sexuality and mind. And this may all result in the feelings of never again being able to work or practice, which was once one's role, work or profession. It may include feelings and even convictions of not being able to be a good parent or a spouse anymore, never again be able to concentrate enough or capable of driving, for instance, a truck, teaching children, or working as a plumber, journalist, or doctor. This again may lead to years of inactivity and pain, a process which in itself is destructive and debilitating. I'm saying this because this is what torture does to people, and it has important repercussions for the issue we are discussing today, namely, how do we ensure that survivors of torture receive reparations? And how do we ensure that their needs as well as their voices are listened to with respect to rehabilitation, including both health and social assistance? And in this discussion, we must constantly remind ourselves that we may be facing individuals who, despite whatever position they come from, may be in a situation where standing up for themselves is the main difficulty. And this may be has very little to do with cultural background or socioeconomic status. It has to do with what torture does to people. So the cases we often discuss where justice has been done, where there are reparations and other forms of compensation, they are often with people whose iron will has survived torture and humiliation, and people with very good support teams. And when it happens, it is after a long time of intense struggle and sacrifice. Because too many people with torture background, even presenting their case or story in court is a heavy and painful process. A friend and a colleague who has served as a psychologist working with the witness support program for the International Tribunal for Former Yugoslavia has told me about nights and days with persons terrified, ashamed, reluctant and in doubt as to whether exposing rape, humiliation, suffering is worth the price. So when we talk about what we all believe in and consider a basic right, namely justice and redress to survivors of torture, We must also take these considerations into account and strengthen programs, as already been mentioned, of witness protection and not to speak of witness care. So to ensure justice and the different forms of reparation, we must also ensure that respect, support and care prior to and respect, support and care after cases of torture are dealt with, for instance in court, are taken very well care of, and that it is to be found high up on the agenda. And again, here, multi-professional action will be needed. So what is... They said it would work. So what is rehabilitation? I won't be able to go far into this, but I personally like just a very short version, making fit again. I will include these slides in the proceedings, so I won't go into details. But again, it is very important what Lorna has mentioned. There are a lot of aspects and many ways of defining rehabilitation, and it can be done. I don't think it will be that complicated, but and there are good definitions out there already. The WHO on the reparations for people with disabilities, one can say that torture may create a lot of functional problems in a person's life, so this will also be able to cover. And it has also been... This one we have? And there are forms of rehabilitation, both in the stricter sense, social, psychological and medical action, but in the broader sense also including social, economic, legal assistance, and also education and employment. All of these constitute important parts of the work we have to do in reparations, or in rehabilitations. So I will say some few words about rehabilitation as reparation. And in international law, it was perhaps first and most clearly formulated in the Convention Against Torture, where Article 14 about redress and fair compensation, including means for full as rehabilitation as possible, is stated very clearly. And I want to make a reference to redress again and to the report that came out in December, a very good overview both of the definitions but also of the history of the definition of rehabilitation within international law. So I suggest all of you to read this. There are very good reasons to believe and argue that this particular form of reparations and the problems involved with it not only relates to questions of definitions and delineations, but more importantly, to lack of mechanisms to ensure that rehabilitation happens, of lack of will to give this priority, and lack of resources, and lack of available and competent services. And the litmus test is, of course, the question raised by CAT under Article 14 to every single state party whose report are under consideration. And their answers often give us, as has been said already, a strong sensation that this is not at all taken care of post. No, I'll give up this. So the questions that are frequently raised are, what measures are in place to secure that persons subject to torture are given redress, including rehabilitation? What kind of rehabilitation, if any, has been awarded to Mr. or Mrs. So-and-so after their torture experiences? What have been done in the area of rehabilitation and redress? What are the statistics, etc.? These are questions often raised. And some of the concluding observations I will just read them out. Like, continue to strengthen efforts in respect to compensation, redress, and rehabilitation in order to provide victims with redress and fair and adequate compensation, including the means for as full rehabilitation as possible, for Sweden, for instance. And for Uzbekistan, it was suggested to provide compensation, redress, and rehabilitation to victims, including means for as full of rehabilitation as possible, etc. So this comes in every single time. But then we can ask, why is it so difficult? Why doesn't it take place? And even when funds are provided to cover rehabilitation, why doesn't it happen? Are there available and competent services to do the work? And, not to speak of, are they trusted by the person in question? In order to reflect upon this, I need to move to a more general discussion about rehabilitation, which often is characterized as necessary assistance to victims of torture, as it said in connection to the UN Voluntary Fund, the need to provide assistance in a purely humanitarian spirit. So the question is, what are the necessary conditions that must be in place to bring out good rehabilitation? And I will try to do this as briefly as possible. Some words about motivation. What do torture victims actually say themselves? Do they often present as needs and priorities after torture? My experience, and the experience of many, is that justice is not necessarily on the top of this list, especially not at the outset after torture. Rather, it is put my life together again, be able to get up in the morning, be able to relate to my family, see myself in the mirror, solve practical problems as housing, economy, and security. These are very often raised as main issues. This does not mean that justice is not important. On the contrary, it is. But nevertheless, these are often issues that are raised. So, as I have already referred to, the persons who are made vulnerable and disempowered by torture will very often need psychosocial assistance before they at all can think about reporting the violations to a more formal body or even think about what may be ahead of them in the sense of claiming accountability, justice and compensation. And to ask about this and embark on such a process rests on the assumption of oneself as sufficiently worthy and respected to be able to do this. So the fear of being exposed, not taken seriously, lose what is left of dignity, may feel experienced as quite paralyzing. And it is here that assistance, psychological as well as medical care, may be a prerequisite for further processes to be possible. And here again, work from redress, for instance, is so important in order So I will just finalize with saying, what are the main aspects, the main conditions that must be taken care of in order for rehabilitation to take place. First of all, of course, there has to be clear the legal context, both about rights, obligations, etc. But then when this is said, there are some things that are very important. First of all, at the outset, after torture has been reported, there must be an assessment and a documentation of torture. The Istanbul Protocol is a very good document for this. And as early as possible, assessment of this and documentation must take place. Also, both to evaluate the need for treatment, but also to evaluate compensation later on. And then there has to be clear responsibilities as to who is actually paying and doing the rehabilitation services. How the state party should not only provide means for rehabilitation, but also see that there is such a system as rehabilitating services in place in the state parties, and many places are nothing or very, very little. There has to be an integrated, multi-professional, well-coordinated aspect to this work, and there must be some stability and some predictability. And there must be social support when the legal processes are taking place, and there should be follow-up and evaluation. So I think I will stop there. I wanted to, a lot more that could be said, of course, but the point is that rehabilitation, there are many aspects, and we have to secure them all the way in order for our wish of rehabilitation for people exposed to torture is a reality. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, I want to thank all the members of the panel. We heard from Christopher the checklist of the roadmap of what the committee ought to be doing, also with ideas as to how to maximize the, I would really say, a clearing house function, receiving and distributing information. We heard from Juan the jurisprudence and with comparisons with the Inter-American system, and Lorna talked about the importance for the victims to have a certain consistency, and mentioned the concluding observations in the case of Chile. That's something to look at. As a matter of fact, this raises an issue that's very important. How the non-governmental organizations have a way in the common law tradition, you know, by interesting lawyering to influence the committee. Because if you look at shadow reports organized in a certain way, they give a roadmap to the a committee as to how to act. And then the change happens sort of in the civil law traditions mode with legislative, you know, syllogistic adoptions and comments. And sometimes there are different opinions in supervisory organs, you know, that prevent from doing things. I mean, legitimate opinions, bodies have that. And then the quality of lawyering and the role for NGOs is very, very important in this respect, as well as the responses by the government. The fact that the government of Chile reacted in a certain way concerning the suggestions and engaged the committee point by point also creates space. And I think that we need to be very creative in finding ways to move ahead in this matter that resembles more, as I say, the common law tradition, more chaotic and organized than the civil law tradition or syllogistic approach. Then we heard from Nora a psychological aspect, the importance of rehabilitation, the role of the Istanbul Protocol and its importance. Now, it seems that we're in cut here. We never have time for doing anything. I mean, it's what I want to propose is this, that we ask questions, and you know, more important than the questions, than the answers are the questions always. They define the realm of possible responses. And Don Quixote used to say it's more important the road than the inn. Eh? So what I propose is that we ask questions and we will find a way to answer them, perhaps during the next panel, perhaps the, you know, these are matters of reflection and so forth and so on. So why don't we, because I would like to finish in the next 8 minutes, 10 minutes, because we really want to hear the presentation by the keynote speaker, Michael Posner, the Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights and Labor. So, but why don't we throw it open for questions, and I say we will find a way to answer them today, or they will live in the minds of the everyone else, and I'm sure they will be acting about it. Yeah, I propose that you stand on the aisle, and people ask questions, introducing themselves. Everyone who talks for more than 2 hours will have a problem with it. No, a couple of minutes will be fine. Yeah. But please introduce yourself for the recording. That one question is enough, Kristen. Come on, let's say no. You want two? Yeah, two shots at the end. Fine. Okay, good. Thank you, Mark. Other questions? Great. So perhaps we will depart from our prior affirmation and we will have a chance to answer. Nora, you're in the committee. We do. I, you want to go first on the victim and on this, and then I will say something.
Oh yeah, I don't think I can say much about the victim. But in Article 14, there's also if the person is dead themselves, or the compensation should be provided to the family. But in practice, we at least I find. If your husband or wife has been tortured to death, even in front of you, of course you're a victim yourself too. And a lot of the so-called indirect torture is also psychological torture. So in that sense, it also falls under Article 1. So I would say that yes, it's more than the direct victim, him herself. Yes, but probably others can supplement. But I'd like to ask about or answer also some of the. On services. Actually, today, you're quite right. Most of the rehabilitation services worldwide are provided by NGOs that are paid by other international bodies like EU, like fund, voluntary fund from UN, etc. So there are very few places. I think some of the exceptions would be Norway, Denmark, and Netherlands that have made it as a political plan to include rehabilitation of torture victims into the ordinary. Public health mainstream services. The bad part of that is that there won't be any good coordinated rehabilitation programs. We'll have to run from this to that. So again, we're fighting also in Scandinavia to have this better organized. But it's seen as something that the health service should deal with. But this happens in very few places. And one thing is the lack of competence or professional knowledge to deal with it, and then you have the political will not to establish it. But it's also, where is rehabilitation possible? And we've had examples of refugees or asylum seekers who have been, their protection case have not been good enough, but one have considered their need for treatment. But then it has been argued, no, there are good psychologists in Sarajevo, so they may, and of course there are good psychologists in Sarajevo, but the person herself who has been raped right there would not profit sufficiently from rehabilitation taking place in a place where you're still insecure, which is a problem in many different places. So there's so many aspects to rehabilitation, but this will not, and it's not my intention at all to excuse any state, because I think that we also in the committee, as we try to do under Article 10, we say not only human rights training and training in CAT or in the Convention Against Torture, but we also talk about training health personnel to detect and treat and document torture. So this is something we should push a lot more and have it in the public health system. Unfortunately, it will be needed many places, rehabilitation programs for victims of torture.
Thank you, Nara. On your question on victim, let me first make a general comment. And Christina is a lawyer in the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. My colleague to the geographic right, and I served in the Inter-American Commission for many years. Making a comparison, the legal system in the Inter-American, the legal approach is more sophisticated in the Inter-American system, and perhaps this is a function of different influences. One is the existence of a court. You know, there is a discussion in supervision whether the Norgan is semi-judicial, judicial. If you have a court that reasons in accordance with the rule of law and find the facts in accordance with the rule of law and the decisions are binding because the treaty says that, that is undoubtedly an organ of judicial supervision. The Committee Against Torture is semi-judicial. It combines both. So you have certain level of inconsistency. It's very important to strive to the highest forms of consistency, of course, because that gives legitimacy to decision-making, particularly when you're semi-judicial. But I need to say that. Now, you find everything in CAT. Also, you find statements in concluding observation concerning victims. For example, torture affects the direct victim as well as the direct victim dependents. See concluding observation of the Committee Against Torture, Namibia, UN document. You find a broader concept, but you don't see a systemic approach to it. In the issue of reparation, also, the Inter-American system has developed the most extensive system of reparation. Material, immaterial damage, let me see, measures of redress, and you know, all these type of things, the changes of laws and so on, and in most of the cases also has been applied, except in the investigation and punishment, but also there is movement there, as one was saying. We saw this when we took the first case. At that time we were not in the commission, it was the first case. The case before the court on Manfredo Velázquez against Honduras. Now, and again, talking at titre personal, I've said that time and again, and we're in an academic setting, I believe to a school of thought that CAT is ready to give sectoriari, to move ahead instead of systematizing certain things. And, you know, people have debates in organs of semi-judicial supervision. This is normal. In my view, for example, the issue of reparation, redress, compensation, I mean, rehabilitation, you name it, require guidance for the legitimacy. And whether that takes the form of a general comment or general comment, we can talk about it. But this is a matter of utmost importance, particularly, also in an organ of judicial supervision, but semi-judicial being perceived as acting coherently is very important. You know, because... At the end, that's a factor of legitimacy. In my personal view also, the systematic analysis of facts, systemic analysis of facts, and the way in which relates to legal reasoning become important. I have identified different type of facts in this respect. Facts that were near, for example, a category of facts is facts that are undisputed, but the assessment of legal effect of the fact is challenged. Facts that were never considered or were regarded in the, disregarded in the national proceedings of the state parties, and cases in which the complainant and the state party dispute relevant facts and evidence. I mean, the idea is to provide a guideline for action to individuals and to governments as to what to act, an NGO. And I think that that's what supervisory organs at a certain point in their evolution do. As you know, in the Inter-American Commission, in the beginning, these type of things also were not systematized. You know, when you had gross and mass violation of human rights, the instruments was visiting loco. Country reports are not, do not require the same type of legal analysis that individual petitions, for example. But in CAT, and if you read the jurisprudence, you start seeing CAT, for example, as a court, as an immigration court. I mean, most of the countries that ratify the article, declare their acceptance of Article 22, were European countries whose main problem is not that they engage in torture, the, or, you know, other forms of inhumane, cruel, or degrading treatment, but there were issues under Article 3. And then these type of cases require a sophisticated analysis. I mean, because when you have systemic tortures, that impacts the burden of proof in a certain way, and so on and so on. But in these immigration cases, if there has been due process internally, what's the standard of review for the supervisory organ? I mean, and I think that the demands, if you will, of the marketplace are requiring a higher degree of legal sophistication. Thinking always in the interest of the victim and giving guidance to governments and petition. And, you know, these are discussions and this taking place, and they should take place, and I don't think that we can draw a parallel with every system, but it reminds me sometimes with the Inter-American system, because in the beginning the Inter-American system faced the same issue. You know, when I was chair of the commission in 1995, I informed the Inter-American, the General Assembly, that we have adopted decisions in 8 cases. You know, it was moving. Now, there are 100 cases pending now in CAT, Joao, 100 cases. Now, what I have seen, however, is the pending of cases in CAT not necessarily bad news for the victims. Because in many of these cases, there are measures adopted that prevent removal. And the length of time creates a situation that at the end, humanitarian consideration, and I haven't done a systematic study, but the sheer length of time creates a situation where the countries are more prone to say, okay, let us leave it because at anyhow, I mean, but I would like to do an analysis there. But I think that we should engage on this. Well, Let me say that I want to thank the people, that my learned colleagues here, and again, thank you for your questions, and we're all looking forward to the presentation of Ambassador Posner. I invite all of you who registered, and also those of you who did not register, but weather permitting and time and space permitting, to join us to the lunch. So let us go there. Thank you very much.